Welcome to Season 3 of the Unscripted Medicine Podcast, a podcast by medical students who live and learn at the University of Cincinnati College of Medicine.
On the show, we host a variety of discussions such as navigating the preclinical and clinical years, exploring humanism in medicine, and developing our physician identities outside of the textbook.
Check out the show notes or our website for more information, helpful links, resources, and more.
Please connect with us via email or on Twitter at @unscripted_med. We would love to hear from you. We hope you enjoy the show. Hello and welcome to the Unscripted Podcast. My name is Rachel Holloway, and I am joined in this episode by my co-host and fellow M2, Alex Gelati. Today's episode is part of our Clinical Communication Pearls series, where we sit down with expert guests to provide students with realistic and practical advice on how to best approach various clinical encounters. In today's episode, we are specifically discussing common barriers to obtaining healthcare and social determinants of health, and how we, as medical students and future providers, can best approach conversations surrounding these issues with our patients. Our expert today is Dr. Andrew Beck, a board-certified pediatrician at Cincinnati Children's Hospital. Dr. Beck has a background in anthropology, receiving his bachelor's from Yale University. He obtained his master's of public health from Harvard University before attending medical school at the University of Pittsburgh, after which he further completed both a pediatrics residency and a fellowship at Cincinnati Children's Hospital. He currently works as a primary care pediatrician and inpatient hospitalist, and also helps lead Cincinnati Children's Community Health Initiative, which seeks to equitably optimize child health outcomes. Today's episode is a really great conversation, and Alex and I both learned so much from the short time that we were able to talk to Dr. Beck. So we hope that you enjoy and that you take as much out of this conversation as we did. Enjoy. All right. Welcome back to the Unscripted Podcast. My name is Rachel Holloway, and today I am joined by Alex Gelati. And today we have on a very special guest, Dr. Andrew Beck. Today's episode is going to be a conversation about social determinants of health and how we as medical students can best approach conversations with our patients regarding barriers to healthcare and ways that we can improve access to quality care. So, Dr. Beck, thanks for coming on.
Thanks so much for having me. It's exciting to be part of this podcast and to talk about a topic that I think is so important.
Yeah, we are super excited to have you. So thank you. I thought we could start off by, for our listeners who may not know, I'm assuming that most people do know what social determinants of health are, but for those who might not know, would you be willing to just define what social determinants of health are?
Absolutely. So the World Health Organization definition is the one that I most commonly turn to. And in brief, or to paraphrase, it's the conditions in which you're born, grow, work, live, and age. And so I think to be even more simple than that, sometimes I think about talking about the social determinants as the context in which we live our daily life. Of course, included within that are the structures, the systems, the policies that determine that context. And in fact, determine those conditions in which you're born, grow, work, live, and age.
Yeah, I think that's a great definition and should be very helpful for our listeners just so that they have like a base understanding of the framework that we're going to be discussing today. I was just wondering, to further help out our listeners and to further the discussion, if you could maybe provide some examples or common barriers that you've personally seen or have heard about that prevent patients from getting adequate health care?
Yeah, I think it's a great question. And I think I would start by stating that the social determinants or context in general can be both positive and negative. We often think about the risks and challenges that are associated with it, but there can also be really good things about that context that promote health. I think the social determinants are the big picture, the air we breathe, the roads we travel on, the opportunities we see, the discrimination that many may feel. but they also then translate to more specific needs or risks that often find their way into our clinics and into our hospital rooms. So one might think about a social determinant like socioeconomic context or poverty, then translating into risks or needs like food insecurity and hunger. So the kind of translation of context into day-to-day challenge is one that I think we often have to find our way around. And when I think about some of the needs and risks and challenges I often see in the clinical setting, they tend to be things like not knowing when you may run out of food for the month, or having a home that is inundated with pests or water damage and a landlord that perhaps is unresponsive. And so this is the way in where, say, the food environment or food access environment or the housing quality determinant then translates into a need or risk, like, say, food insecurity or housing, adverse housing conditions.
Yeah, those are great examples. And I think that you bring up a really great point about the positives and the negatives. I think a lot of medical students, when we have these conversations, we talk about just the negatives. And then I think it's another thing to think about the translation into clinical care and how you can actually identify patients and families who are at risk and who we can play a role in helping, hopefully. I was just wondering, I think that when medical students are having these conversations, there are a lot of myths about social determinants of health or biases that people have, whether or not they believe that they actually play a role in someone's care or things like that. So I was wondering, do you think that medical students in particular have implicit biases when interacting with patients who have a known barrier to healthcare?
So I think implicit biases and frankly explicit biases too are a part of medicine, whether we like it or not. I think that's true for medical students, but it's not just medical students. I think it's true for all of us. And I think it's it needs to be part of our approach to clinical care to understand where those biases may come into play so that we can identify them and then mitigate them. One thing that I would say is that the social determinants affect us all. Sometimes the balance of determinants may be more positive than negative. Sometimes the context in which we find our way through life is a bit easier for some and harder for others, but it's always a balance. And that's true no matter who you are or where you are. And we also know that individuals, families, households go through ups and downs. And so the mere fact that someone may have a risk or challenge today may not mean that they have a risk or challenge tomorrow. Similarly, the family or household that has that seemingly has it all together may certainly not have it all together and may have challenges that they experience on a day-to-day basis. And so I think the main thing I would say is, look, we all know the evidence is clear that we all have biases, be they implicit or explicit. We need to ensure that explicit biases are stricken from the care that we provide. And we need to identify, understand, and then seek to eliminate those implicit biases that truly plague all of us. It's none of us are immune from that. And then pursue conversations around the social determinants of health with empathy and that seek to build trust in the relationship such that we're not asking a question to check a box. We're asking a question to learn more about the lived experience of that particular family, patient, or household, and then understand if there are things we can do to circumvent a risk should it be present.
Yeah, so understanding the logistics of how you identify a patient who might be at risk for a negative like a negative social determinant of health, a barrier to healthcare, would be helpful in this situation, especially maybe just personally for me. But I would assume that, you know, as an I'm an M2 and Alex is an M2, so I haven't really necessarily experienced this in the clinic personally. But for my clarification, are there? I guess my question is, what are the steps in a clinic situation that would help to identify a family or a patient who is at risk of suffering from these barriers to healthcare?
So I would say that different clinical settings approach screening for social needs in different ways. So I would be prepared for that as you encounter your clinical rotations, both in medical school and beyond. Let me describe, though, a little bit about how we do it in the clinical settings in which I practice, either in our primary care center at Children's or on our inpatient units. In our primary care center at Children's, we've been screening for health-relevant, health-related social needs for 10 to 15 years. The questions that we ask, some of them come from sources in the literature that have been published and trialed and used all across the country. Others we've co-created with our families, our partners, with social workers, with clinical community agencies or agencies that we partnered with, like Legal Aid. But we ask specific questions about food insecurity, housing instability or insecurity, housing exposures, challenges with transportation, concerns related to mental illness, as well as other relevant or related social risk factors. Now, we've done this a few different ways over the years, and I don't know that the evidence suggests that one way is clearly better than another, but there are some that ask these questions face-to-face, say a provider, be that a nurse, a doctor, a medical student. There are others where it's asked face-to-face on intake by the nurse or the MA that might be bringing the patient back. There are others that may have it on paper and you check boxes. And now, more recently, we have it on tablets where a family may be checking in and answer some of these questions on tablets that then get uploaded into the electronic health record for us to review as part of the visit. Now, regardless of that way in which it's pursued, whether it be on paper, whether it be on a tablet, or whether it be face-to-face, I encourage people to see those initial screening questions as the start of a conversation. So a no to our food insecurity question does not necessarily mean that that family isn't struggling with putting food on the table. Mm-hmm. Similarly, a no on a request for help may not mean that with deeper conversation, with a deeper relationship built, there may not be aspects in which or interventions we can pursue within the clinical encounter that would be helpful. And so I think regardless of the way in which social screening is introduced, I would encourage listeners to see that as the start of a conversation, a start of a back and forth that ideally builds trust with the person on the other end of that conversation, to dive more deeply into what that lived context truly means for that family, and what might be of relevance to health for the patient and those that care for them. In our setting, we still provide these questions at a routine basis, generally every 3 or so months, understanding that circumstances often change. And on the inpatient units, we've tried to integrate assessments for some of these challenges more consistently into admission history and physicals, because we know that taking advantage of a touch point might provide the opportunity for discussion around how that risk might affect an individual's health, and potentially an avenue in for either us as the provider or us in partnership with our collaborators to think through potential strategies to make that lived experience a little bit better.
Yeah, I think you bring up a great point about these surveys are just the stepping stone in these conversations. Over the summer, I did a project on social determinants of health, and a lot of patients would answer no because they didn't know like why we're asking these questions. They didn't think like, I'm going to see a physician, what are they going to do about my food insecurity? And so they would just say like, no, I don't need help, because they're like, what are you going to do for me? Especially normally the communities who might need the most help tend to be overlooked or marginalized in the health community. So, or the health field. So they already have a bad experience. It already takes them so much to even like see you at their office that they're like, you're not going to care enough about that. So I think that's a great point for students, especially students who may need to use checklists to like figure out what they have to do in their clinical encounters, that you need to go beyond that. Kind of touching upon that, and we were talking about like administering it and how to best do it. How do we do it in such a way to avoid like discrimination? Like for, like we see a patient and we're like, oh, they obviously have social determinants. Like how do students like avoid that?
So it's a good question. And it harkens back to that discussion of implicit bias. I think in many ways, for one, I would normalize it and perhaps standardize it. I think the way you look certainly will not necessarily determine whether you're hungry or not. And so I think going into it to say, I'm going to ask everybody, and I'm going to do it in a way that normalizes this, the asking of the question. And I'm going to do it in a way that is non-judgmental, that is highlights a degree of trust and empathy that will only enhance the clinical relationship, whether you identify a risk or not. I think by showing you care and doing it in a way that says, I'm not doing this to judge. I'm not doing this to turn you into the authorities. I'm going to do this because we know it's important for health, and we care about you. We care about the patient. We care about your outcomes. And we want to provide the best possible care we can. And so I think probably, you know, for one, when in doubt, standardize in medicine. You know, perhaps that's not always appropriate, but a lot of what we do follows standardized protocols. I think perhaps standardizing this could be important to normalize it and to say that we think that ensuring that our patients have food to eat and live in an environment that supports as opposed to detracts from health is something critical to their clinical care. And so because of that, we're going to commit to focusing attention on that lived experience, on that context, because we know it to be so relevant to the outcomes we're trying to push toward.
Yeah, that's so helpful. I'm wondering, do you have any, I'm sure it depends on the specific patient and their family and their specific situation, but do you have any go-to phrases or things that you try to avoid saying in different scenarios, or is it kind of more dependent upon the patient and their specific scenario?
I certainly think there is some dependent on the situation, but you know, one of the things I do to normalize is I tell people, I ask everybody this question. You know, I'll lay mm-hmm. out some phrase like that to say, I ask everyone this question. Sometimes I'll follow it with something like, we ask because we care and because sometimes there are things we can do to help. Mm-hmm. So I'll provide that kind of, I'll normalize it. I'll provide the rationale. Sometimes I'll provide examples of some of the things we can provide, because there are times when someone may check a no box because they may think there's nothing that we can do to help. And so sometimes I'll say, oh, by the way, did you know that we now have a food pantry in our clinic? So if ever you find that you're having trouble, we want you to know that we're here and could provide an emergency food supply. So sometimes I'll provide that indication that we're not just asking because we're nosy or want to pry, but because potentially there's something we can do about it. And so I think the normalization, the rationalization, and then the depiction of what the efferent arm or what the intervention or action step might be, I think go a long way toward building that trust into the discussion. There are times too, you know, particularly for conditions like asthma, as an example, which in pediatrics is mm-hmm. our most common chronic condition, I'll often highlight the link between, say, housing conditions and morbidity from the disease, to again draw that parallel directly. Like, we know the housing environment affects health. We want to help ensure that this patient, this child, this family is living in an environment that supports as opposed to detracts from that health. So, you know, again, providing the reasoning there, I think sometimes is important.
So I have two follow-up questions based off some things you've said. One, how do you find the time to administer the social determinants of health survey? I feel like with average patient interaction being like 12 to 15 minutes at best, how do you find that time? And secondly, how do you frame it in a way where patients don't feel bad for these situations, like they're at fault when you say, hey, yeah, your kid like with asthma, like the housing like links with higher morbidity rate, mortality rates for your child, and without making the patients or the parents feel guilty for being in this situation?
Those are both good questions and both challenging questions. I would say, so to the first one, to the time, yes, we're all busy. We're all stretched. Clinic visits feel rapid. The way we do our screens now is generally that the families will fill out some of this before or on intake. So before I go in the room or before a clinician goes in the room, and then we can react to it. But I've built some of that reaction to it into my into the history that I take, particularly for preventive care visits, for well child checks and the like. I would also say, though, that although visits are quick, oftentimes, and this is a learned skill that I am still learning for sure, but prioritization is really important during clinic visits. So there are times when it's super fast. You know, there's a simple complaint or it's a preventive care visit and the kid's doing absolutely wonderful and it's in and out. There are other times, though, where the family has plenty of concerns, be they medical or non-medical, or you as the provider have plenty of concerns, that fitting everything into a 10, 15, 20 minute visit is probably going to be impossible. And so then it's a matter of saying, what are the priorities for that visit? There may be some, if there's medical acuity, that take precedence. But beyond that, probably the priority should be what matters to the family. And so that kind of frame of like, what is your number one priority today? Or what is the thing that is most bothersome, most concerning, most worrisome that we can help you with today? And the flip is to say, from the provider perspective, what do I think is most likely to cause this child ill health, harm, danger? And sometimes a deep conversation about putting food on the table is going to be more important than, say, the number of hours of TV they watch, or whether the pet stays in their room or not. You know, there are we could ask 100 different things at primary care visits, and when you were M3s, you will likely go through the exercise of asking all 100 things during those visits. But there is a time when you have to think about prioritization and what is going to be most important. And there are times when we've done that and had to say, you know, look, if the social social or environmental conditions in which this family is living is influencing the health of the child, of the patient. I keep saying child because I'm a pediatrician, but influencing the health of the patient in a substantial way, and influencing quality of life and their ability to meet their potential, then that warrants my focus and that warrants the prioritization on that visit. So that's one. The second question, I've forgotten. But it was a really good question. I remember. Yeah,
sorry.
I remember that much.
Oh, I'm sorry. I asked both at the same time. But my second question was, how do we approach these conversations without the parents the patient feeling guilty that they're in these situations?
Yes, that is a That is a really important question. I think it's embedded within the comment I made about being non-judgmental and normalizing. And oftentimes, oftentimes there are other factors at play that that perhaps there is fault somewhere, but it is absolutely not the patient or family. So we've had many times where housing issues have been raised and it is actually a legal affront to the parent, patient, or family. And we need to step in and advocate for them, with them, against, say, a landlord who is threatening or another entity like that, that may be an intervention like a legal aid advocate who can truly be the representation for that family, at their behest. The family directs the show, but to support them in that way and elevate them. But I think the idea of normalization and being non-judgmental go a long way, and highlight that, depending on statistics, 20% of Hamilton County is food insecure, and 40% of children live in poverty. These are normal, sadly normal, but normal experiences that many have. What we aim to do is not to wag a finger or to be judgmental. It's to say, this is not your fault. This is not anyone's fault. In some situations, and in other situations, it is someone's fault, and we want to hold them accountable for it. That I think is part of our role as being advocates and true partners with families in mitigating these challenges.
That's really good. Thank you, Dr. Beck. That was some really valuable advice to carry into the clinic, and I just feel like I'm learning so much. My next question is, say that you have started this conversation with a family and you've identified that they have certain barriers or negative things that are impacting their health. What can we as medical students and what can we as physicians do as those next steps? What resources do we have? What is that next step?
So let me start there with the resources for the next step, because sometimes there are tangible next steps and other times they're a little bit more abstract. And I will say there's quite a bit of variability clinical site to clinical site. So I am lucky, and those of us who practice at Children's are lucky to have a number of resources in clinic. So in our primary care center, we have excellent social workers and community resource navigators or liaisons. We have community health workers too, who can often be a real resource to families. We have an infant formula program for formula-fed infants who are running out or diluting. We have a food pantry on site. We have a robust partnership with legal aid, who are highly adept at challenges related to affronts to rights related to public benefits, housing, educational challenges, family law, et cetera. So a number of excellent resources at Children's. So for those of you who rotate through our primary care center, that is often, or some assemblage of those, is the next step. And that's okay. That's wonderful. There are other sites around town and around the country that do not have those resources. And there are times when having at least a knowledge of what community resources might exist could be beneficial. So around Cincinnati, the United Way 211 line is something I'll often turn to. 211, kind of like 911, is a number you can call for community resources. There's also a web presence where you can seek out potential sites of, say, food pantries or places to get furniture for cheap, or transportation, or things like that. So being able to understand like a few examples of places you could turn should there be no on-site resources is of value. I also think, even short of resources, the conversation that one can have with a family around their lived experience can have value in and of itself to, again, build that connection with the family and build their connection with that medical clinical site, to ideally, again, show that we care that we support, and our goal is to best meet the needs and goals of that particular family. I will say, as medical students, you do have some luxury still of time. I joked before that you'll ask the 120 things, right, that we have to include in a well visit. But I think there's real value that med students can bring in the time that you can spend talking to, getting to know, and building that relationship with the family, whether it be in a primary care encounter or on an inpatient unit during a clinical stay. And I wouldn't undersell the importance of that relationship, either in that moment or in the moments that will follow when that family perhaps feels more welcome, perhaps feels more like there is value in coming to that clinical location and will come back to receive preventive care, even if we aren't able to directly address perhaps the social need that was raised or that may be present. Or that may not be present that day, but may be present next week, next month, or next year.
Yeah, you're just giving us a whole bunch of information that is going to be super helpful for us when we get on rotations. And I'm sure current M1s will find it extremely helpful as they continue on with their clinical experience. As we wrap up, I was just wondering, could you give us any resources? I know you gave us a few that we could go to if we want to learn more about social determinants of health and how to best advocate for our patients.
Yeah, so there, I'll put it into a few categories. One, I'll say there's a lot of research being done on this right now. So if there are listeners who are interested in the academic side of this and the cutting edge of research into social needs screening and interventions, I would point towards SIREN, which is a group out of the University of California, San Francisco, that I've been involved with for a number of years that highlight some of the best practices around the country who in terms of how groups are working on this. And they have a wonderful library of articles. They have a listserv that sends out monthly updates of new programs that are being evaluated and put into place. It's really a wonderful resource. I think another category might be what we're doing as it pertains to population community health locally. I mentioned 211 as a resource, but to think about or learn a bit more about the health equity oriented work that really is bolstered by clinical community partnership, co-design with patients, families, and partners. I'd encourage people to turn to the All Children Thrive Learning Network. It is a motor by which a lot of our work is occurring that brings in parents and partners from all across the city to try and really figure out what matters most to those that walk through our doors. And then the other thing I would say would be to periodically check in at the Cincinnati Children's Community Health Initiative, work that we are doing in partnership with many across the community, including the Community Engagement Corps at the CCTST, which is across the broader University of Cincinnati Academic Medical Center, work that will progress certainly into the next 10 or 15 years, where we hope to produce and find ourselves on a pathway toward excellent and equitable health for all kids within our region.
Well, thank you so much for all those resources. For our listeners, those will include the links into our show notes. Once again, thank you, Dr. Beck, for being on the podcast with us. It was a blast and we learned a lot.
Well, thank you guys. It was so good to be a part of this. And I look forward to seeing all of you and meeting all of you when you come through Children's.